Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad you could join us for a little bit of baseball card talk as we go back and forth between the big old monster box and the big old binder. And again, to be totally upfront and honest here, these cards are not actually in a binder, at least the ones that we're looking at over the next few weeks. They're in a small box that would eventually find its way to a binder if I had time to put them in there. But some pretty interesting cards and players in this box, and especially in the 74 and 76 top slots that I bought at a local card shop a while ago. And 74 tops is our random pull here. And, you know, it was just middle of a stack of cards. I just reach in and pull it out. And not only do I get the great 74 tops set, but also we've got Dusty Baker. Random pull, card number 320 from the 74 tops set. Great batting stance pose shot here of Dusty Baker wearing the old Atlanta Braves uniform. You know, their softball uniform. Everybody had a softball uniform for the most part in the early to mid-70s. But the uniform that Hank Aaron, of course, made popular with his 715th home run, Dusty Baker modeling here. And the point of trivia with Dusty Baker and Hank Aaron, Dusty Baker was on deck when Hank hit number 715 at Fulton County Stadium on April the 8th, 1974. So we'll talk a little bit about Dusty Baker, also give you some news on the auction pack break that we've been doing for a while. We're going to do a little revision to it, so we'll give you some hints about that. And then we'll update you on what everybody else is talking about. If you don't already follow us on Twitter at Wax and Gumstains, well, give us a follow and tell your friends about the Wax and Gumstains Twitter feed, because that is where we link up all of our shows, but we always have a conversation ongoing, whether it's about our podcast, whether it's about the auction breaks, whether it's about the players we talk about or the sets we talk about. There's always something going on there. So make sure if you're not following Wax and Gumstains on Twitter, tell your friend or friends, if you're popular, tell the people you know. I hope you have more than one friend. Tell your friends who were collectors, whether they were back in the day or they still collect now. There's always a conversation that loops everybody in, and I'm sure they'll enjoy the time that they spend checking out what everybody else has to say. But first, let's talk a little bit about 74 Topps. This is one of my favorite sets from the 70s, and Topps really had a pretty solid run of sets in the 70s. Now, I wasn't a huge fan of the 1970s set. I know quite a few of our listeners are, but even if you put 1970 aside, because that's one of those tomato-tomato situations there, from 71 through 78, I think Topps really had a good stretch of cards there. Now, some were better than others. Some were more wild and zany than others. You know, 72 and 75 stand out because of their design. Well, you look at sets like 74, 76, 78, some very simple designs that are fan favorites. Of course, you have some major rookie cards throughout that time, starting with Carlton Fisk in 72. You would have George Brett and Robin Yount and a whole slew of cards of rookies, you know, Mike Schmidt in 73. Just a bunch of big names, players who would become stars in the mid to late 70s and well into the 1980s. But 74 Topps has, over time, really become one of my favorite Topps sets of all time. And, you know, the more I've looked at these cards over the, you know, especially the last couple of years, but during the production of this podcast, which is a little over a year now, I realize how much I took 74 Topps for granted. It is really an outstanding set. And 74 Topps would have been a perfect set had it not been for one glaring error. And I'm not going to get into the full details of it here. I will direct you to our podcast, our previous podcast on 74 Topps, which featured Don Sutton as our random poll, Little D, as he was known with the Dodgers in the 60s. But I will give you the skinny version of the story, and that is, of course, the failed move of the San Diego Padres to the Washington, D.C. area. It was one of baseball's worst-kept secrets. The Padres were a terrible expansion team, had really little fan support at the time. The ownership was not good. They were running out of money. And by the middle of the 73 baseball season, it seemed pretty evident that the Padres were going to move to Washington, D.C. The D.C. area had just lost their second team. The second Washington Senators had moved to Texas in 1972. So there was an ownership group in place, and the National League had already had a plan in place as to how to repay the city of San Diego for losing the Padres. But then the deal started faltering. The financial backers started pulling out, or there were some that were actually dealing with criminal issues at the time. And by Christmas of 73, the Padres didn't seem to be destined for Washington, D.C. Well, around this time, Topps is producing the set, and 1974 would be the first set that they produced as one single series. No longer were they releasing cards in 5, 6, 7 series over the course of a season. So they were producing it in one series. They were selling the complete set exclusively through the JCPenney store catalog. And, you know, this is one of those deals where you have to fish or cut bait. So finally, Topps says, okay, we're going to take the pictures of the San Diego players. We're going to design their cards to where the card would normally say San Diego Padres in the banners. We're just going to put Washington up top and an abbreviated National League at the bottom. Well, as we all know by now, the Padres would stay in San Diego. In fact, the deal completely fell apart that winter. Ray Kroc, the owner of the McDonald's Corporation, comes in, saves the Padres, signs a long-term lease, basically commits to keeping the Padres in San Diego and making it work there. And Topps was caught a little red-handed, as they had already started production. Well, instead of scrapping the entire production, they just said, okay, we're just going to correct the card. And that has made for 18 variation cards of the Padres. Not all of the Padres were affected, as we've noted before. Dave Winfield, his rookie card, you can only get a San Diego Padres card. It does not say Washington. But there are several notable cards, including Willie McCovey, who had the Washington designation. So that is a collector favorite. People try to find both variations of the cards. And I've seen a little bit of a heavier emphasis, or a higher cost, I should say, on the Washington cards, because those are obviously the more rare versions of the cards that are out there. But if you're looking for a Washington card outside of Willie McCovey, you can find them relatively easy. You know, this isn't like a T206 Honus Wagner. You can look around for them just a little bit, but you can find them relatively easy and relatively cheap too, and especially if you're not too concerned about the condition of the card. If you just want a Washington card for the sake of it and you're fine with an excellent or a near mint condition card, then you can get them pretty cheap. But that was the one huge blemish on what would have been an otherwise perfect set. And of course, Topps really had no control over that. But Topps releasing its first year, or first set that was just one series, a 660 card set. And it had everything. First, you had the tribute to Hank Aaron, the first few cards in the set, because going into the 74 season, Aaron was sitting on 713 home runs. So other than a career-ending injury, you knew he was going to break the record. So Topps starts the set with the tribute cards. You also have, as I mentioned, Dave Winfield's rookie card is big. Dave Parker's rookie card is in there as well. There are several other semi-star rookie cards, if you will, players who had pretty good careers throughout the 70s and into the 80s. So you can find some pretty good cards, some good rookies, first-year cards a single photo card of Mike Schmidt, because his rookie card in 73 was one of those three-player rookie cards that Topps was known to produce throughout the 1970s. So you can get Mike Schmidt's second Topps card. It's the first card where he alone is featured on the card. As I mentioned, Carlton Fisk, and I do have that card. That's actually in this box. A great action shot. And, you know, Topps had scaled back the action shots after going insanely overboard in 1973, but the Carlton Fisk 74 Topps card is a thing of beauty. And you've got a lot of stars carrying over from the 1960s. Like I mentioned, Willie McCovey is in there. Nolan Ryan was starting to become a household name at this point in time. And, guys like Steve Carlton, he was really ramping up his career, Pete Rose at the time. So you've got a pretty good mix of rookies and star cards. And, of course, with Hank Aaron just being the king of baseball in 1974, you could find his card as well as that tribute. And also you had the first traded set where Topps, actually was able to use the winter meetings time to its advantage, the players who were traded in between the World Series and the production of the set, so that, Topps had about 6 to 8 weeks to pull this together. They would airbrush the cards, and you would have this giant kind of military font, traded, plastered across the front of the card there. And then on the back, a narrative as to, which team the player was going, from and to, and who else was involved in the deal. So, a lot of novel concepts being included in the 74 top set. And I think something that has also helped the 74 set retain a lot of its popularity is the design. As we look at this Dusty Baker card, and it is just it's a thing of beauty, even though there's a lot of space dedicated to border on this card. And I know, a lot of collectors don't like borders. They just want more pictures, more action, more, creativity and less of just white space around the edges. I think it actually works well for the 74 top set because it does have a little bit of the Polaroid feel Polaroid was just ruling the photography world back in the 70s. And it just kind of had that general look. It's almost like you took a picture of Dusty Baker and, this card was spit out of your camera. That's kind of the feel that you got from it. So the white border actually works on this. And then after that, it's simplicity. You've got some great, let's use another picture novelty of the time, Kodachrome, from the Kodak company. You've got a very good selection of photographs, even the staged photos, like this Dusty Baker one. I mean, the colors pop on this thing. You've got this light blue sky. You've got the beautiful green grass of, what looks to be a spring training field. And here's Dusty in that dark blue Braves uniform with the red on the tulip on the shoulder pops, the red in the lowercase a on the Braves hat pops. That's one of my favorite Braves hats too. I'm in the process of getting one again. I had one in high school, but obviously my noggin's grown a little bit in the last 25 years, so I gotta get another one. But the colors of the uniforms, the colors of the setting blend in very well. And, it's even a posed photograph like this. It's a work of art. The photography for the most part is very, very sharp in this set. So even though only about 80 to 85% of the front of the card is dedicated to the picture because of that border space, the pictures really make the border work. And like I said, the colors, even though this is on gray cardstock, you've got some pretty vivid photography on here, and that's very nice. And then the work that is inside the borders is also pretty good and pretty simple. This was the first year where he had the two banners that would grace a Topps front. The second year was 1980, and in 74, the banners were kind of more like pennant flags. There's one up top, one on the bottom. But in 1980, it was a sash, and I mentioned that you know, the 80s set, it's more like the slightly overweight beauty contestant Sashi. You know, it just has kind of this bloated look to it. 74 tops is very, very clean. The flag up top would have the city name that the team was associated with. The flag at the bottom would have the team nickname. And next to the flags up top, you had the player's position. At the bottom, you had the player's name. And that was it. It was all very linear, very colorful, very sharp, very simple. And a far cry from what you saw just a couple of years before in 72, and certainly what you would see the next year in 1975, where Topps just took the paint cans out and splashed color everywhere. So, you know, I think with context, and that's always a key thing when you're looking back at these sets, you know, 40 plus years later, with context, I think you get a greater appreciation for certain sets. Like I said, I think I took 74 Topps for granted. I often overlooked it, despite the fact that you had the star power and, you know, he had the photography. I often just remembered 74 Topps as the set with the Washington cards in it. But there are some really great cards in this set. And let's flip it over real quickly, take a look at the back. Even on the gray card stock, the ever popular Topps Green came through nice and clear here. As I've mentioned before, green, especially dark green, was a very popular color for Topps to use in their sets in the 1970s. Now, they had used it before in 1967, but they would use it ad nauseum throughout the 70s, 1971, 74, 76, and 77, and 79 all featured a heavy dose of dark green, and that would carry on into the 80s as well, as dark green was the prominent color on the backs of 82 Topps. You can see up here in the upper left-hand corner, very simple circle with the card number. You would have the player's legal name, as you can see here, Johnny B. Baker, although Dusty in the faux autograph located next to it. And you would see the faux autographs make an appearance on Topps cards a lot, although moving forward, you would see them on the front of the cards. But they loved putting on the autographs on the cards throughout the 1970s and into the early 1980s. But it's a good thing Dusty calls himself Dusty, because Johnny B. Baker just sounds like a Chuck Berry song. I mean, all respect, it's his name, but I could imagine he probably got ridiculed a little bit with the name out there, so he just went with Dusty. But yeah, the complete stats located in the lower left-hand corner. You had a couple of tidbits, if space permitted, up top, and you know, Dusty had just really started getting his career going at this point in time. What's interesting, though, and I just noticed this now, but in the Major League record, you have a count of at-bats, but you don't have a count of games. And that's something that you would normally see in cards leading up to this point here. So I find it kind of interesting that that was a stat that was left out. It's not like they didn't have room for it. They probably could have shrunk the typesetting for a couple of these other stats. But you would have most of the important stats from a career, if space permitted, a couple tidbits. And then on the right side, you had this panel that had the personal information of the player, height, weight, you know, city he was born in, etc. And then you would have a cartoon, which the cartoons in the mid-70s, I'm telling you, if you don't look close enough at some of these cards, you're really missing out. But some of the cartoons are just hysterical, whether it's the drawing itself or the factoid that is presented with it. And the Dusty Baker card is no exception here, as Dusty did some broad jumping in high school. And you've got this little baseball player kind of jumping up in the air. So there you go. Dusty did some broad jumping in high school. And the broads have never been the same since. Brum-chink. All right, so that's 74 Topps, really one of my favorite sets. And again, it's something I kind of wish I didn't take for granted. But through the acquisition of a couple of lots, including the one that I got this past summer, and, you know, this was, you know, a couple of separate purchases. I got a stack of cards from the 60s and a stack of cards from the 70s from a local card shop. The 74 stack that I have, probably about 30 or 40 cards, A lot of stars and semi-stars in that stack. But I remember a couple years ago purchasing a lot of just random 1970s cards from eBay, and I got a great deal where I think it was about 350 or 400 cards from 73 through 78, I think, maybe 79, but definitely 73 through 77. I think I had some from the late 70s, but I got a great deal on that, and a lot of those cards were 74 tops. And you know, I think as I was thumbing through them and just seeing, you know, what kind of cards I got, I started realizing this is actually a pretty good set. You know, I counted it as plain before, but I think, you know, looking at it closer, you see it's not really plain. It's simple, but it's clean. And like I said, the combination of the design, the photography, the color selection, and then on top of that, the rookies, the stars, the semi-stars, the you know, the Hank Aaron tribute, the introduction of the traded set. It's really a great set, despite the goof-up with the San Diego Padres cards that Topps feverishly had to go back and find. Now, 74 Topps is still somewhat available to the general public in the sense that you can go to a local card shop, find plenty of these cards, you know, typically just sitting in a box somewhere. And as I've said before, if you're not concerned about condition of the cards, I would say go out and just get a handful of them. You can find them, you know, again, card shops and dealers, you know, they don't make money off of common cards from the 1970s, so they'll let you have them for a steal. If the card's in, you know, somewhat decent shape, you could probably get a common card for as little as, you know, 20 cents a pop here. So you can go home with a couple hundred cards, and it's only costing you 20 or 30 bucks. So you can find it that way. Also, 74 Topps can still be found in the form of wax packs. You can find unopened 74 Topps wax packs. They're not cheap. They're typically bid up to around $100 a piece. And some of these wax packs, you have to be very careful. These aren't your typical 10 or 12 card packs. Topps did produce some lower count packs at that time. So make sure that if you're going to spend $100 on an unopened wax pack, it's not just a two-card demo wax pack, because you're spending $100 on two cards that you could probably get at your local card shop for 20 cents. Also, I always like to put out the reminder that if you buy any vintage wax packs, be very, very, very careful where you get them from. Make sure you're buying them from a reputable dealer. And if you're buying it online, take very, very, very close looks at the pictures. Make sure that there's no peeling back of some of the wax on the back. It should be a nice flat surface. Doesn't look like it was rolled on by hand or super glued. Also, you know, the edges and the corners need to be nice and neat and sharp. And always make sure that the wax pack that is pictured is the one that you are indeed purchasing. If that is not the case, unfortunately, you do have some unscrupulous people who will buy old wrappers and will stack them up with 10 common cards that are in near mint or mint condition and very nicely, neatly close them up and try to sell those packs of cards that are worth maybe, you know, $1.50 or $2 collectively. They try to sell it for $100. So always be wary of that. It's certainly a lot easier to buy the wax packs in person, but if you do get a chance to buy vintage wax and you get your hands on a 74 Topps pack, good for you. That's kind of where the line of demarcation is between readily available packs and packs that you really have to search for and often pay out the nose for. 1976 is really that line. There's more 76 Topps out there than you would think. But, you know, the mid-70s, you can still find some packs for decent prices. throughout auction sites and card shows and card shops. So I would strongly suggest getting your hands on some 74 Tops. It's a fun set. It's a good looking set. And if you're somebody who looks for the stars inside those packs and not just, you know, you're not necessarily like me where you're just happy to have old cards, then you can definitely find some good stuff out there, as a Dusty will give you this mean glare if you pull that card out of the pack. He had a little snarl to him. And let's take a look at the career of Dusty Baker, a guy who, like I said, really not until 1972 got his career going. He was coming out of Sacramento, California. He was drafted by the Braves in 1967 and began his career at the major league level in 1968. So thrown right into the fire, even though it was more of a cup of coffee situation for him still, 1968, Dusty was only 19 years old. So the writing was on the wall as to how successful of a player Dusty was going to be. He only had six games in 68, three games in 1969, but you knew he could make solid contact, and you know that he could knock the ball out of the park. But at the same time, there was a little bit of a logjam in the Braves outfield. Of course, Hank Aaron was still a very serviceable outfielder in the late 60s and early 70s. But you also, along the way, you would have Ralph Garr would come along. You would also have, the Braves would try pushing Sonny Jackson out there to, get something out of him. Mike Lum was another young outfielder who would play for the Braves at the time. And also, as Dusty was breaking in, the Braves still had the big bat of one Rico Carty. So once Carty got moved from Atlanta, and once, the Sonny Jackson experiment didn't work out, and Hank Aaron was starting to age a little more, Dusty was able to get worked into the lineup a lot more, really making his major league impact in 1972, appearing in 127 games. From then on, he would be a force with the Braves throughout the mid-1970s. Like I mentioned, he was on deck during Hank Aaron's 715th home run. He was a pretty good hitter in terms of average. He would hit, in his time with Atlanta, I would say, around 270 was a pretty average batting average for him. He would average 20 home runs a season, rack up around 80 RBI a season as well, and, was starting to make his name for himself, or make a name for himself, I should say, for an Atlanta team that was just not that good. Well, the Braves decide to rebuild in the mid-70s. They send Hank Aaron off to Milwaukee, trying to find an amicable end to his time in Atlanta. And also, Dusty would be on the move after the 1975 season, as he and Ed Goodson go to the Dodgers for Lee Lacy, Tom Pashorek, Jerry Royster, and Jim Wynn. So pretty obvious that the Dodgers were just merely stocking up for a pretty good run in the 1970s, while the Braves were adding some spare parts and some players who were well past their time at this point in time. So it's in LA where really the spotlight shines on Dusty Baker. Now, he battled some injuries throughout the 76 season, but in 77 and 78, a key contributor to the Dodgers' postseason success. In fact, he was the playoff MVP, or excuse me, the championship series MVP for the Dodgers in their four-game series victory over the Phillies. And why not? He batted 357 in four games, had a couple home runs, drove in eight runs as well. And even though the Dodgers would lose to the Yankees in the World Series, still a pretty productive postseason for him there, hitting .292 in six games. Also, key hits in the 78 playoffs, in the Championship Series against Philadelphia, and the World Series against the Yankees, again suffering the agony of defeat as the Dodgers did. But Dusty would prevail as he continued to produce in the late 70s and going into the early 1980s. A 1980 season, he was actually in the MVP running. He was a Silver Slugger, finished fourth in MVP voting. Now, that was the year that Mike Schmidt ran away with the MVP vote, but still, Dusty with .294 batting average, 29 home runs, 97 RBI. And in the strike-shortened 1981 season, he's finally recognized for his accomplishments with his first All-Star appearance. appearance, and he would have another pretty solid 81 season and another remarkable performance in the league championship series against the Montreal Expos, hitting .316 in that five-game series. Didn't quite wield the power as much as he did in the championship series as the other two playoff series. You had a division series because of the split season against Houston, and then the Dodgers would match up with the Yankees once again in the World Series. But he will take those smaller numbers in the stats stacks, if you will, in exchange for a World Series victory, which the Dodgers finally got as they beat the Yankees that year. Another all-star performance for him in 1982 at the age of 33. He was hitting .300, had 23 home runs, 88 RBI while playing in 147 games. Now, Father Time would start taking its toll on Dusty. He had a pretty productive 1983 season, but as he's entering into his mid-30s, the Dodgers decide to move on as they started bringing in some younger, more talented outfielders, very similar to what Dusty dealt with 10 years prior in Atlanta. This time he was being moved out. So heading into the 1984 season, he becomes a free agent. He signs with the San Francisco Giants and has a decent time there. 100 total games in the 1984 season while batting .292. And then after the 1984 season, he is on the move once again, getting traded by the Giants to the crosstown rival Oakland A's for Ed Pecunis and Dan Winters, two players who never made it out of the minor leagues. And at this time, Dusty Baker's career starts winding down in Oakland. 111 games with the A's in 1985, batting .268. And in 1986, he bats .240 over 83 games. But the time is up for Dusty and the A's, as the A's also going through a youth movement, eventually building into that powerhouse team that we would all know and love in the 1980s. But Dusty would hang him up after the 86 season, playing in 19 years, 2,039 games, a career batting average of .278, 242 home runs, 1,013 RBI, and as I mentioned, a two-time All-Star and a couple times finishing top 10 in the MVP voting. Now, while his playing career is pretty spectacular, it's his managing career that most people know him for and not necessarily love him for. Although his first stint as a major league coach and manager was pretty good to write home about. In fact, he was the hitting coach for the Giants from 1989 to 92. Actually, let me back up. He started as a first base coach for the Giants in 88. Then he was the hitting coach, and this was, you know, the Giants team that would match up against the A's in the 89 World Series. A Giants team that doesn't really get the credit it deserves because they got swept by the A's. But boy, you talk about some power, and you're going to look good as a hitting coach when you've got Will Clark and Matt Williams and a whole lot of other talented players on that team there. And then when Roger Craig stepped down as manager heading into the 1993 season, Dusty Baker comes in. He wins the National League Manager of the Year Award. The Giants finish with a record of 103 wins and 59 losses, but they don't make the playoffs. It's one of the few times that a team finishes with more than 100 wins and doesn't make it to the postseason. And that's simply because the Atlanta Braves literally caught fire. Fulton County Stadium literally caught fire in the summer of 93. The Braves just turn it on into overdrive, and the Braves finish with one more win. That's right, a 104-58 record. So the Giants get shut down literally in the final weekend of the season. In fact, losing their playoff bid in the season finale, the final series of the season, of course, to the rival Dodgers. And that was one that stung the Giants for a very, very long time. Now, the Giants would go on through a little bit of a rebuilding at this time, but they would win division titles in 1997 and 2000, thanks in part not only to Dusty Baker's manager experience and guiding him. But of course, Barry Bonds signing as a free agent in 1993. They had a pretty decent pitching staff too, for the most part, if I recall. And the Giants were a pretty good but not great team. But in 2002, it was the Giants' turn to get into the World Series. They would face the Anaheim Angels in a very, very entertaining seven-game series. But it was only entertaining because, well, Dusty was being Dusty. And this was the first of many questionable calls that Dusty Baker would make in his managerial career, and he still does, that would come back to bite him. Game 6 of the 2002 World Series, Russ Ortiz is pitching. He's allowed only 4 hits, and Baker removes him from the game. Well, the Angels come back. They win 6-5, and they would also go on to win Game 7 of that series, so the Angels winning their first World Series. The Giants still looking for their first World Series win since 1954. So once again, coming close, but Dusty Baker tempting fate with the pitching change, and a lot of Giants fans would make sure that that hung over his head. Also, that was the World Series where his son, who was a bat boy, nearly got run over by a Giants player during play. His son went out to go out and pick up a bat that was left at the plate during the play, and you have the base runner coming in, and that's his son, Darren, by the way. And if it wasn't for JT Snow, on deck watching the play unfold, if it wasn't for JT Snow running out there and pulling Darren off the plate, he would have just been absolutely steamrolled by the base runner. So thankfully for Dusty and Darren, JT Snow was paying attention to the play at the plate, not just merely watching what was going on around the base paths. So Dusty, because of his failure in the 2002 World Series and the infamous pulling of Russ Ortiz after Game 6, well, he gets let go by the Giants, and he moves on to the Chicago Cubs. Well, the 2003 Cubs also making this phenomenal run towards the World Series. And 2003 was infamously remembered for the Steve Bartman play in the National League Championship Series with the Florida Marlins. But let's not forget that Dusty had his hand in making the Cubs come up a little short too. As opposed to pulling pitchers out too early, he would often overuse his pitchers, most notably Kerry Wood, but also Mark Pryor. In fact, a lot of people will say Pryor's career was basically ruined by Dusty Baker overusing him from 2003 to 2006. And, Pryor would never find that magic touch that he had earlier in the decade. So after the 2006 season, when the Cubs just fall absolutely flat, you know, just 3 years removed from being a few outs, I think it was 5 outs away from making it to the World Series, they end up 66-96. So Dusty is shown the door in lieu of Lou Piniella, and Baker gets into broadcasting for just a little bit, but then gets hired by the Cincinnati Reds after the 2007 season. Now, when Dusty was first in Cincinnati, the team was not very good. Couple of sub-500 seasons in 2008 and 2009, but they break through in 2010, win the Central Division title, and have an early exit at the hands of the Philadelphia Phillies, who, I mean, now you look back, I mean, that team was just a buzzsaw at that point in their existence. So even though it was a sweep at the hands of the Phillies, Baker signs an extension. The Reds have, a couple more pretty good seasons, including the 2012 season where they clinched the Central Division Championship again. But even though they make the playoffs, they can't just make that big leap forward and get to the National League Championship Series, and certainly not a World Series. So he is let go from the Reds after the 2013 season. And heading into 2016, he was hired as the manager of the Washington Nationals. And we've seen a lot of the same things happen here with the Nationals that we saw with the Reds in terms of, you know, getting to the playoffs but not winning a playoff series. And it's been well documented with the Nationals losing to the Cubs not that long ago in the playoffs. It's been well documented that Washington teams have not seen any success in the playoffs. And that's not just baseball, that's all teams. But also, you're starting to see a little bit of the questionable pitching moves that got him in trouble in San Francisco many years before. And you know, the best example I can think of actually happened not that long ago, just maybe, a week ago, where Max Scherzer is just dealing, and he allowed, I think, 4 hits. I'm trying to remember how many innings he pitched. I want to say maybe 7 innings, and Dusty goes to the bullpen, and the bullpen blows at the Cubs when, you know, a crucial game. And, you know, the rest is history. The Cubs are able to put the Nationals away, go on to take the Dodgers in the National League Championship Series. And as of this moment, as I am speaking, his term as manager in Washington is up in the air. You know, the Nationals, this is their window. They're running away with the National League East Division. But, you know, there's going to be a big day, a big payday for Bryce Harper coming here. So do they keep him? Do they let him walk? I mean, if there's going to be a time for the Nationals to win, it's got to be now. And Dusty, you know, really messed things up again, you know, with the call to pull Scherzer early in that particular game. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because you have to wonder with Dusty's track record of getting teams to the playoffs, but not necessarily managing pitching staffs well and not being able to get teams over the hump, how long his managerial career will go. Because he is, first of all, starting to get up there in age. Dusty Baker, in case you were wondering, is 68 years old. Now, that's certainly not old for many baseball managers, but certain teams like to go with the younger managers now, especially those teams that are more cognizant of advanced statistics and stuff like that. But, you know, with some of the questionable calls that he has made, there's a lot of concern of, you know, can he actually manage a team that can get over the hump and eventually win a World Series, and can he get out of his own way? His career managerial record as of the end of the 2017 baseball season is actually pretty decent. He's got a winning percentage of .532, and it's the postseason that always bites him in the butt. You know, his win-loss record in 55 games is 23-32. Now, we should also mention that Baker is a member of the National Advisory Board for Positive Coaching Alliance, so very cool thing there. And you may recall I mentioned Darren was saved by JT Snow in the 2002 World Series. Well, Darren is now a member of the Washington Nationals organization. He was drafted in the 27th round of the 2017 amateur draft. But it'll be interesting to see if Dusty can, you know, if he gets one more year in Washington, can he finally get that team over the hump and get them into a position to win? And like I said before, can he get out of his own way? Because that is unfortunately, more often than not, cost Dusty certainly the 2002 World Series, perhaps a playoff run with the 2003 Chicago Cubs with overuse of some of his pitchers. And I'm sure Nationals fans, if you're even listening to this podcast, because I'm sure you're still pretty fed up with what he did, you know, the Nationals fans are probably wondering, well, what if? What if they left Scherzer in there and, you know, the Nationals win? You know, how are they match up against the Dodgers? Well, who knows? Who knows? So that's our look at Dusty Baker, card number 320 of 74 tops. Let's take a quick look at our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. That is where you will find Wax Ecstatic on Twitter. And again, please share that link with your friends and let them know that we've always got some pretty interesting conversations going on. A lot of conversations about our last podcast featuring Jack Aker of 69 Tops. He was a member of the Seattle Pilots very briefly, as I mentioned in the podcast, traded to the Yankees about 6 weeks into the season. And Timothy Jenkins, responding to our tweet of the 45 record of the Seattle Pilots fight song, as he belts out some of the lyrics here. Go, go, you Pilots, you proud Seattle team. Go, go, you Pilots, go out and build a dream. Just look up Seattle Pilots on YouTube, and you will find the Seattle Pilots fight song. It's quite Mickey Mouse clubbish. If you remember the old Mickey Mouse Club TV show from the 1950s, it had kind of that childish marching band sound to it. But also, I failed to mention this in the podcast, but if you go to seattlepilots.com, it's a site that hasn't been maintained in a while. It's been kind of stagnant for, I think, 7 or 8 years. But you can find a lot of great pictures, a lot of great memories, and even some radio play-by-play. Somebody, I think, from actually the 1970 spring training schedule, tape recorded a broadcast where the Pilots broadcasters are wondering if they're going to have a job because the team was threatening to move to Milwaukee. Also, Baseball Minutia chimes in on that record and says, I love this. It's like my favorite Archie's cutout from Honeycombs. Yeah, remember when they actually would send you records in your breakfast cereals and you had to cut it out? You know, it was this big square acetate and you had to, you know, cut it, make it kind of round, and then you would listen to it. Although a lot of that stuff, you know, it was kind of like the Ovaltine radio scene in A Christmas Story. You know, there was a song, but it was basically just pitching a product. Brady Umfleet, catching up on episodes, really enjoying them. Well, thank you, Brady. Just noticed the 70 Tops set has players' names in cursive. You may have mentioned in the 70 episode, I overlooked this for years. And I don't know if I mentioned it in the episode. Maybe I did, or if I didn't, well, now I know about it. But yeah, it's just so funny when you take a look at some of these cards, you don't realize certain details until you take a really close look at them. For example, 74 Tops, you know, just today. You know, I'm looking and I go, wait a minute, they didn't list the number of games that Dusty Baker played. So, you know, it was pretty interesting that, you know, it wasn't until now that I've noticed this. And I've had at least one 74 Tops card in my possession for probably 25 years, but I just didn't notice it till now. So that's part of the fun thing about doing this show, taking a second, or in some cases, third or fourth look at some of these cards, and not only appreciating the cards more, but picking up little details such as that, that really stands out. And you'll notice, Brady, if you want to, you know, look ahead to some other sets, the 71 Tops, it wasn't in cursive, but all the names were in lowercase. So, you know, Tops would do neat little graphic things like that to just shake things up just a little bit. But, you know, until you sit down and you look at these cards and you really pay attention to them, you don't notice some of the details in here. And I think that's really one of the fun things about looking back, especially in the 60s and 70s, looking back at some of these cards and picking out the little minutia, if you will, from some of these cardboard classics. And finally, real quick, I want to throw in a quick note about the Wax Ecstatic auction breaks. We had a little time off because I've been busy with my job, but we were able to do one this past weekend. Robert in Denver picked up 3 cello packs of 85 Fleer. We opened them up, and spoiler alert here, he was able to get a Dwight Gooden, the first base set card for Dwight Gooden, and also a Cal Ripken Jr. card, and a whole lot of Hall of Famers. There's Steve Carlton and some should-be Hall of Famers like Jack Morris. You know, actually a pretty good assortment of cards. So good for Robert. We're going to ship those cards out to you soon. But we're going to take a little pause with the Wax Ecstatic auction breaks as I try to reinvent how we do that, because there's interest, but there's not really enough interest to keep it going the way we're going. So I will post something this week with some details on how we're thinking of switching it up. But just to let you know, I'm thinking of doing something almost like a subscription service where you pay either a monthly fee or an annual fee. It's hard to say, you know, I want to keep the price low. But basically, you're buying into an auction break club. So you will have the chance to not only, you know, bid for these particular packs, but what we'll do with those fees is go out and buy some really good vintage stuff. Obviously, I want to find some good packs to offer up to our listeners. But, you know, maybe we've got a couple packs of, you know, 1980 Tops that we just stash aside, and we make that like a monthly grand prize, something like that. So you're bidding on these packs to be opened, but you're also, basically becoming a member of an auction break club that will also give you bonus packs every now and then. And we won't open them. We'll just send them to you, you know, fully closed, just, you know, wrap them up and send them your way. So that's kind of what I'm thinking. I don't want to spend too much time talking about it now, but I'll put it down on paper and we'll share it. And, you know, I want to get your feedback because it's tough for me to ask for money up front for something, but I think it's something that will pay off for those who are participating because, again, you not only get the chance to bid on some, you know, really cool packs, but you'll have a chance to occasionally, and this would just be a chance drawing. I would just pick out somebody's name. You would have the chance to win some extra wax on the side just for being a member, basically. So we'll see how that works out. Like I said, I'll put it down on paper and we'll share it. But I also invite your ideas too. How can we make the Wax Ecstatic wax break or wax auction break a little more appealing to everybody? Because I think we're putting out some good packs. We get some activity, but not as much as I would think. I know your answer might be, well, Matt, just feature something from the late 70s. Well, we've done that a couple of times and we haven't gotten quite the activity that I thought we would on some of these. So it's not as simple as just change the product. There's got to be a little more excitement, and hopefully we can kind of generate that. So I'm open to your ideas as well, and you can just chime in on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, or once you see my proposal, once I put it out there, then you could just reply to it and let me know, hey, that's a great idea, or hey, that's a dumb idea, or hey, have you thought about this idea? And we'll kick it around and just kind of come up with something that's a good deal for everybody. Well, that'll wrap up our program for this week. Make sure you join us on Friday for another flashback edition, a Friday flashback. So we take a look back at some classic sets and some not so classic sets. We'll look at a few duds along the way as well. But really enjoy being able to look back at some of our older episodes. We post those flashback editions on Friday. And we have new episodes every Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock Eastern time. So make sure you join us next week for another random pull from our little box of cards that'll end up going into the big old binder. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next week.